The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Prepare your ears, humans. Happy, Sad, Confused begins now.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, a deep dive into House of the Dragon with Patty Considine. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz, and yes, we have the king himself, Viserys, is on the show today. And I'm just going to say this up front, spoiler warnings galore. I would highly recommend watching at least through episode 8 of House of the Dragon before proceeding, because this is an open and honest chat with the great actor that is Patty Considine about a fantastic first season on House of the Dragon. Okay, spoilers? Good? Good. Okay, as you know by now, Patty has just wrapped up his run on the show. His run as Viserys, King Viserys, came to an end in episode 8, in a beautiful episode, and we dive into all of it today. This is a great chat with an actor I've long admired. If you've seen him in way back when, I remember him first perhaps in America, the great Jim Sheridan movie. If you haven't seen that, he's been in a bunch of Shane Meadows work over the years, has done great work on the stage and in both the West End and here on Broadway. And now in his, certainly his most high profile role, because you know, you don't get much bigger in pop culture than the new Game of Thrones show. And this one has captured the imagination of folks, and this performance in particular has captured the imagination of folks, including George R.R. Martin, who has said that basically he did this character better service than his own writing. And so that is the highest praise I can imagine. So this is a great chat with an actor, a self-deprecating, but a truly talented actor in Patty Considine. Other things to mention before we dive into this chat. Let's see, just a bunch more events I should mention. You know, again, if you want to see me in person talking to some amazing folks, we got a bunch of options coming up for you. Let's see, October 25th at Symphony Space, Ralph Macchio talking about his memoir, Waxing On, Karate Kid, My Cousin Vinny, Cobra Kai, all of it. October 26th at 92nd Street Y, I'm going to be talking to Henry Cavill, and yes, we have a lot to talk about, guys. Enola Holmes 2 is the film that he's promoting, but we are going to go into The Witcher and Superman, past, present, and perhaps future. More to come on that. And on November 11th, guys, I'm talking to Sylvester Stallone and Terrence Winter about their new show, Tulsa King. Yeah, a deep dive with Sly Stallone. I am really psyched for that one. And it segues well into this conversation today, because Patty actually is a huge Rocky fan, like maybe the biggest Rocky fan on the planet. We talk about that love here, talk about his love of horror films. And for those of you that want to watch this one, and I would recommend actually watching the video of this one, because Patty shows off some great Halloween items, but also some memorabilia, some souvenirs really from the set of House of the Dragon. So if you want to watch this, go over to youtube.com/Josh Horowitz. All these links are in the show notes. Remember to hit up the Patreon page. We're putting up exclusive content there, including, by the way, exclusive stuff we shot with Sam Heughan at Comic-Con. That is going up only on the Patreon page, at least for now. I think I might keep it there. Patreon.com/happysadconfused for exclusive Sam Heughan stuff that we shot at Comic-Con. That's super fun. That's a lot, isn't it? It's a lot. All right, let's get to the main event. House of the Dragon fans, you are not going to be disappointed. This is, we really focus on the show, but certainly talk about the broader aspects of his career. But I think you'll enjoy this. This is me and Patty Considine. Patty Considine, finally on the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast. It's a real pleasure, sir. Thanks, man.
No, thanks for having me.
So, first of all, you come, not only am I a fan, but you come highly recommended. Matt Smith and Edgar Wright both have vouched for you as a good human being to me.
Yeah, Yeah.
I don't know what you have over on them.
I had to smack them around a little bit to get them to say that, you know.
You tell Josh I'm good.
Yeah.
I smack them around a little bit, a little beating here and there. Yeah. How was doing the press tour with Matt by your side? I talked to Claire Foya, who's done had to do that a lot over the years, and I know it's a tough road. Yeah. How was it for you?
It's all right. It's all right. It's a bit of an assault, you know, if you're not used to doing it. And, you know, it's like retraining your brain again to try and deal with it all. It's, you know, and particularly like post the pandemic thing. I know it seems like it's fading in the distance now, but, you know, I think forgot how to behave quite a bit, you know, and just it was really weird. But the press tour went well enough. I found it a bit odd, really, because, you know, you're there with the show, you're unknown, and there's a kind of buzz about something that nobody's seen. So you're there talking about a show that nobody has any idea if it's going to succeed or fail. You're playing some boring king as far as they're concerned, you know, some good king who's kind of a boring guy. And you're having to sit there and tolerate all the nonsense and just in the back of your mind going, I wish, you know, if I was in season two, for example, it'd probably be a lot easier.
Well, the good news is now you're getting a little bit of a run to get to, you know, dig into the juicy stuff. And it's just a remarkable arc for your character and a great first season for the show. But before we get to the show itself, I just do want to mention, I see the jack-o'-lantern behind you, and I've been informed that you are a big Halloween guy. Now, my understanding growing up was that Halloween isn't necessarily as big overseas as it is in the States, but was that not the case for you?
No, well, obviously its roots are in Celtic. It's a Celtic thing. You know, it went over to America, so it wasn't originally from America, Halloween.
Well, we appropriated it and made it into a McDonald's holiday like we do everything. Yeah, exactly.
But if I'm honest though, when I was a little kid, it wasn't a big thing in England, but we did used to do stuff as little kids. You know, we'd make pumpkins out of potatoes and wrap ourselves in newspaper. My mum and my next door neighbor would like wrap us in newspaper with pins and make little witches costumes when we were really little. So it was obviously around then. But I think my love of Halloween grew up, my love of horror films and also, you know, American movies. You know, as a kid, you'd watch films like E.T. and it'd be Halloween and you wish that it was like over here because it wasn't at the time. But it's grown more massive over the last, 20 years or more in England.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about your horror movie taste, because Edgar was saying you're just like a fanatic for horror films, and like you're a couple years older than me, but we both kind of sound like we came of age in the 80s, and I know that there was the bit of the slasher films of the era, but then we have John Carpenter in that era. What's your Mount Rushmore of horror? What's your like top five?
Well, I love Carpenter. I absolutely love Carpenter as a filmmaker. I think he's amazing. What an amazing body of work in that period of time from Halloween, you know, onwards. But you know something, like Edgar Wright, Edgar's one of those people that's a real filmo and can talk about film. And I'm not really that sort of guy. I'm not a factoid on things. And I just like the things that I like, you know. But my first experience of seeing a horror film or a horror moment was when Salem's Lot was on television in England, and I was only a little kid, and I woke up in one of those weird deliriums, you know, and gone downstairs, and the rest of my family were all sitting up really late watching the television. So I sort of crept into the room and sat at my mother's feet, and I'm going, what's everybody watching, you know, because they were just like glued to this thing. And it was a scene in the police cell where you first see Mr. Barlow, and there was this prison cell, you know, and I'm going, what's going on? And then the lock, and then the claws, and then, oh, you know, and I leapt like a cat from the floor onto my mother's lap and screamed like, not just scared, hysterically. And I loved horror from that moment onwards, but I was scared of watching horror films. The first of the Halloween films, it wasn't even the original, it was on video, and it was the John Carpenter.
Right.
It was Halloween 2. Sorry,
got it.
And it was Halloween 2, sorry. So I didn't really see the original, but I was watching that, just terrified. That was the first horror film that I braved sitting through, actually sat through it and thought, I'm going to try and watch this and not leave the room. So that was quite a triumph. But there was another funny one. I remember, like, at the time, because The Evil Dead was banned in Britain and you couldn't kind of watch it on the cinema, and it wasn't around on video. So all they had was people would have pirate videos of it and have these little viewing gatherings. And I got sent to fetch my sister from a friend's house. And I walked to the house and I knocked on the door, and it was pitch black in the day. And my sister's friend answered the door and said, "What do you want?" And I said, "My mum sent me to get Mandy." She went, "Come in. We're watching somewhere, but be quiet." And I walked in and I stood in the edge of the doorway and I'm looking at this film playing. And again, this gang of kids are all glued to watching it. And I can see this film, and it's like, it looks blue, you know, it's got a blue filter on it, and it's nighttime and it looks blue. And then you see Bruce Campbell and all that. And I'm going, I didn't know anything about it. I'm a kid, and I'm looking, I'm going, "Oh, this is blue." And I'm like, "Oh, this is what they must mean by a blue movie." You know, like a porno film. Sure. I didn't have any concept. Went, "Oh, so this is a blue movie," you know.
Very, very literal. Yeah.
And then the next minute, it must have been a bad pirate. And the next minute she shoots out of the ground, you know, and he chops her head off with the spade. And I was just like,
it's funny because, like, I get it. I totally relate. I have those memories too of seeing, like, you know, the It miniseries as a kid, of seeing The Exorcist on a late night when and the edited version even of The Exorcist on like basic cable still just scarred me for life in the best possible way. But those stick with you, and it's fantastic. I'm curious, like, you actually haven't worked, like, have you ever worked with any of, like, the quote unquote horror masters? Have you, haven't done like the, I don't know, the Cronenberg, the Carpenter? It hasn't happened yet, has it?
No, never have, you know, never have, and probably never will, really. But it's all right. You know, sometimes I just prefer being a fan of things, and, you know, I can just sit back from afar and enjoy it. And I think, you know, sometimes when you get involved with things that you love, and you know, you see behind the curtain, and you go, "Oh, I kind of wish I hadn't done that now." The magic's been spoiled. And in what we do, you know, we're constantly, you know, seeing behind the scenes of it all. And I just want to keep that illusion there in some respects with something. So I don't have a burning desire to be in a horror film or anything like that. I'm just a massive fan.
That's fair. I could see you, I feel like, as a, what, you got something there?
Oh, I've got lots of things, lots of Halloween.
What do you got?
Three little mini masks here, and
I love it.
All kinds of crazy stuff. I've got my Halloween tree, a Ouija board, trick or treat studios, and it's all a little bit of a mess at the minute.
Is there a Halloween night tradition?
It is for us, yeah. You recognize that guy.
That's amazing. Does the family support your obsessions?
Yeah, they love it. Well, you know, my little daughter as well is a big fan of horror. She has been for years. She watched the Chucky films way too young, but she loved them. And the first horror film she watched was Mama. And walked in the room and caught her watching it. And she was about four or five years old. And we were like going, "She shouldn't be seeing that." And then I was outside, you know, sweeping up or whatever I was doing in the garden, and I found a piece of paper and opened it. And it was a little drawing and a little note she'd written to Mama and thrown out of her window that night, you know, to give her a message. And I went, "Oh God, I might have awakened something." You know, well, she's awakened something there. But she's always been fascinated with horror herself. So, we go to all these conventions together.
Oh, really? That's fantastic. We just had a Comic-Con here in New York, so it's always fun for me to walk around that insanity. I do want to talk. Let's get into, I mean, we could talk about horror for hours, but let's talk about House of the Dragon, because it's fresh on my mind, and you have just, man, you've completed an amazing run on the show. Congratulations. Like, this is, it's stellar stuff. I know, I don't know how good you are at taking compliments, but you must be feeling, I don't know. Tell me about this. Like, cause my sense in reading about you is you are tough on yourself. How does that jibe with what people are saying about what you've done with this character, which is very positive stuff? Are you able to accept the love? That's a no.
Truthfully, no. It's strange. I don't know if it's part of me and part of my condition or whatever, or a condition of mine, but I just, you know, but I'll put it this way. All right, I'm not great at accepting things, but I, I'm I'm okay to acknowledge that, you know, I'm rarely feel any fulfillment from anything that I do in work wise, you know. And I think for so many years, I was sort of in the background a little bit, even if it was, you know, films that I made myself and
right.
They were, you know, these big expressions and explorations. I still felt like I was sidelined in them in some way. And then, so I think to finally sort of be in something where I feel like when I played Viserys, like a lot of things came together for me in that part. It became quite personal for me. And I think for a long time, feeling sort of partially sidelined to be able to be in something like that on this scale and for it to be global. I think it was, I don't want to call it an arrival, but there's a part of me that was always going, hello, I'm here. I'm capable of doing these things. I just want the chance. And in England, I was just becoming the guy from Dead Man's Shoes. And it'd been like that for nearly 20 years. And after a while, you got to appreciate you love the film, but I'm capable of so much more than that. But that's all I was becoming.
Right.
And I knew that I could do other things. I just wanted the chance. And, you know, Viserys and House of the Dragon gave me the chance. And, you know, I loved the character from the beginning, from the minute I read him. And I thought he was a massive gift. And I've said this in other interviews, but, you know, I always, in a very self-deprecating way, but I always say, who's turned this down then? Who don't want to do it? Because, like, this is great. And it's like, well, nobody's turn it down because they haven't offered it to anybody. It's yours if you want to do it. And I've got to give full credit to Miguel Sapochnik and Ryan Condal. They were the people I met first and had a conversation about it, for thinking of me for it and offering me it. I thought it was a gift, but there was a definite sort of, there's something redemptive in it for me that I felt like, oh, finally, they've seen what I can do, and they are that invisible they.
No,
you know,
and it's hard to quantify, you know what I mean? That, and it's hard to. Yeah. And I get it though, but like, yeah, because I'm sure in your brain, for those of us with active brains that think about this stuff, it's like, wait, yeah, if and when I get the shot, if and when I get that center role in the center of culture, what if I fail? What if people don't give a shit? What if, like, yeah, and then it, and it's the good news about this conversation is, not only did people watch, yeah, they really accepted it with love. And
easily
and
not happened. Yeah. I mean, I genuinely, that aside though as well, I genuinely loved the character.
Yeah.
And I worked really hard on him and put a lot into him. And George R.R. Martin's been really complimentary about what I brought to it. And, you know, it was a really tough job, but I felt that sense of fulfillment that I rarely, if ever, feel. And, you know, and I think you're allowed to feel that every now and again.
Yeah.
I just felt like all the hard work I'd done, I know I wasn't trained as an actor in any way.
Right.
And I always felt there was a part of the puzzle missing with me. I always felt like a bit of an imposter. I wouldn't go so far as to say I didn't think I had talent, because that'd be untrue. But I don't know, there's a part of me that was always hiding and holding back and, you know, just feeling uncomfortable. And I got to a point of acting in this country and I was going, I don't know what to do with myself anymore. I'm trying to break the mold in some way, but I can't escape my beginnings in acting. You know, I can't get away from that. And like I said, I'm capable of so much more.
What you're saying resonates. And honestly, it's maybe the most recurring narrative in my conversations with the folks over the 8 years of doing this podcast, is like, I trust the ones that have the imposter syndrome and I don't trust the ones that feel like they are entitled. I mean, as you say, you know yourself enough to know you're obviously very talented, but I don't know. We all the good ones feel enough self-doubt that keeps them sharp and keeps them.
Yeah, you know, and I could have just carried on doing similar things in this country. And I could have stayed in my lane and at my level, whatever that yeah. is, you know, like I was told once. But I'm like, no, I'm here because this is a choice I made and it's a journey and it's not a sprint either. It's a marathon and I'm here to learn. I'm not saying I'm the finished article. I never want to be that, but I just felt that there was all this untapped potential. And I went out to make myself uncomfortable. I wrote and directed my own films and went through the glory and the absolute disappointment of that. I took myself, well, I got these opportunities, but you've got to turn up. I went and did a play. I was never going to do a play. We did that in the West End, eventually on Broadway. I was never going to do Broadway. That was never a plan of mine. But it came, and it was a life-changing experience. And I just feel like during that period of time, I got to have an education. I got the chance to learn a little bit more about acting, because, you know, there's this argument about natural talent and craft and things like that. And I'm like, well, you know, if you've got some natural talent, what's wrong with kind of bringing in some craft to that?
Right.
There's nothing wrong with it. Right. If I was a fighter, I'd be a great trainer. If they can make me a more refined fighter, then you'd learn the craft. So that's all it was ever about for me. And I think all those lessons came to came to a collision, and you know, through Viserys Targaryen. I just think that I was able to, all those lessons I learned, I was able to put them into him.
Yeah.
And deliver that kind of performance.
So when this one comes around, as you said, like it was something clearly you wanted to do. But I mean, and you knew, presumably when they come to you, they say, I mean, the character is the character. We know his end at the beginning. And by the way, this is spoiler alert stuff for folks that haven't seen through to the end of episode 7, 8. Maybe take a pause. But I assume they said from the beginning, this is the first season. This is what's going to happen. You're only in it for the first season, but we're going to trace the arc of this. Like, would you have been interested if they said this is potentially going to be stretched out over 3 to 5 years, or was the one season of it all exciting for you?
Not if it wasn't going to be an interesting character. I didn't want to be standing there in armor for God knows how many months and years of my life, and just, you know, every now. And I've been offered jobs on epic things and in the past, and it all sounded very exciting. And then when you got the script and looked at it, you were literally standing in the background with a spear, and all these other actors got to play, and you stepped up. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that, you know. So this was different. I think when I read it, it didn't bother me that it was one season, because he had a story. He had a beginning, middle, and an end. And I thought he was a beautifully brilliant, complex character. You know, it used to drive me nuts when people talked about him as, you know, you're weak, you know, and all this. And I'm like, I think you're underestimating me, you know. Viserys was no idiot in my eyes. And he certainly wasn't weak. That's for sure. And it was interesting watching that tide turn from the beginnings of the show. You know, it was a bit of a competition. It was all about favoritism and things like that. And I'm not here for any fucker's competition. I'm not here to be your mate or to be anybody's favorite. I'm here to play Viserys Targaryen. And a friend messaged me today, actually, and they said, you watching it, they said, like, now seeing the end of it, it's almost like at the beginning, like, you knew who he was from the beginning. And I'm like, yeah, I did. And I think that was the difference. I knew who he was from the start. I just had a sense of him from the very, very beginning. And to be able to have one season, but to be able to go in and make an impact like that, I think what more would I want, really?
Yeah.
I mean, I could turn up year after year and dip in and dip out, and you wouldn't see me for 4 episodes. I'm like, No, I came in and I did it and I died and I'm gone and that's it.
That's it.
Why not?
You've been very kind in talking about the director and the creators and the writers and your fellow actors. And I want to get the pronunciation of her name right. Schonbrook, is that how you pronounce her name?
Yeah, Schonbrook, yeah.
Who you've been saying, like, that's the key to the character for you, is the loss of that character.
Yeah.
That really casts a shadow, and down to his dying breath.
Yeah.
And that was clear to you from the start. This was going to be the inciting incident, or the incident that would really just cast a shadow over the rest of his life.
Yeah, I understood what that event did to him. I had an idea what it did to him. But because you take on a character, and I'm talking about acting so naff and pretentious, you go on a journey, and because I've directed as well, when I direct, I'm very open to things moving. you know, like the first film I wrote and directed, Tyrannosaur, it was scripted. It wasn't improvised film, it was scripted and they stuck to the script. But ideas came and went in it, new avenues opened as we were making it. And I was never afraid to explore those possibilities. And I think I'm like that as an actor as well, particularly when you're living with a character for a really long period of time. So yeah, what I'm saying is you're receptive. I'm very receptive to things and people and events. So when I knew that the death of Emma would devastate Viserys, but until we shot it and I worked with Sean for what was just a few days, and I think what determined it was because what we shot was 10 times more brutal than what you saw. And he was 10 times more devastated than what you saw. I mean, he was inconsolable. He was absolutely distraught. And there was a scene that didn't make the cut where I'm sitting on the bed, there's blood on the bed, and I've got the dagger. And one of the maesters brings, I don't know if he brings Balon to me, and I can't even look at him. Or I think the thing was, he comes to tell me that actually Balon hasn't lived. And so Viserys was hit with this double whack of devastation of his wife and then the kid, you know, his son. And then there was this sense of like, you know, like that cruel twist of fate of like, I'm not surprised, you know, I'm not surprised.
Resignation, but just like amused resignation. Yeah.
And they cut it and probably rightly so, because it just cuts them to the funeral pyre. And that's probably the right choice, really. But it was just the impact of those scenes, the amount of emotion that we put into it and the amount of effort and emotion that Sian put into it. There was such long, hard days filming, and she left such an impression with her work, even in the more tender scenes, that she left a kind of imprint everywhere, and she left this impression on me. Yeah. And it just changed the course of how I played the character. I just went, this is it. This is the thing that this man carries for the rest of his life. And this is the thing that he can't get over. And my secret then became, you know, when she's burning, it's like, I don't want to live anymore. So when he's starting to get these injuries from the throne, and he's starting to get this kind of, you know, the stuff on his back, the blistering on his back. When it starts to develop into something else, he doesn't care because, you know, if you look at the story, he doesn't ask the maesters for a cure. He's not scared. He's not going, help me, my arm's falling off. It's everybody else going, let's try the leeches. Let's try this. Oh, there's an old technique. He's not. He's just silently accepting his fate by way of punishment for what he put his wife through in those final moments. And that's how those days with Sian changed the way that I went about the character, because secretly, I just went, this is a love story, and one day he'll be reunited. So by the final scene, when he's lying on the bed, and all I had in my head was that he reaches up and touches her face, and then I improvised that moment where I say, my love. And the beautiful thing as well about that episode was that they just picked up every nuance. You give good work to people and they don't see it. They don't see the little moments. They don't see the crown falling off the head and use it. You know, they stop and go again. Whereas the accidents are where beautiful things happen. And Geeta allowed for these things to happen. And not only that, put these little nuances in, put those moments in. And I was really grateful because, you know, a lot of your performance too depends on the work of everybody else and the choices they make in the edit. And I can say with my hand on my heart that I thought the choices they made were fantastic.
It's funny because what you're talking about, like people talk about improvisation, et cetera, but like the point is, these are building on the foundation, the building blocks of the script and your actors. And the two things you've just mentioned of that deathbed moment and that, like, I'm going to get like emotional just thinking about you and Matt, it's just like it says so much about that relationship, that very complex relationship that as crazy as this story is, we all can relate to. Many of us have brothers and sisters and it's a human extrapolation of what's on the page. It's fantastic.
Well, you know, the messages I got from people who were just like, I watched my parent die, and that's what it was like. And I went, well, that's what it was like for me when I watched my father die. And that's what I played in those moments. And the shocking thing was when my wife said, you've got to just see this last bit, because I don't really watch myself. And she goes, you've got to watch, just got to watch this last bit when you go. And I went, okay. And the first thing she put on was this image of me in the bed. And I just burst out crying. And, you know, my daughter, Frano, came over and put her arms around me. And I went, it didn't just remind me of my dad. I looked the image of my dad when he was dying, you know, and that was a real shock. I didn't know it was going to be like that at all. And that was frightening. Amazing. But that's what we do, you know. That's what we do.
Yeah. So you haven't watched, it sounds like you haven't been watching the show. Will you watch it now? I mean, now you can watch it from a distance, or is that going to be weird?
I look, you know, I'm a funny creature. I'm I'm very self-critical and cripplingly so. And, you know, I feel like I watched the first episode a couple of times. We had our premieres and I crept into the second episode and saw bits of the third, but not all of it. And okay. And then my wife showed me a scene from one of the others and I thought I was awful in it. And then I couldn't watch it anymore. You know, I watched other people's bits. I watched some of the other people's scenes in the show. You know, I made sure I looked at my colleagues and my comrades and saw what they were up to. So it's not like, but I couldn't, you know, and it kind of did my nut in for weeks. And I went, I can't watch this fucking thing. It doesn't matter if Scorsese, De Niro, Pacino, and Sam Rockwell, all the people I love. Phil Hoffman were there standing in the line going, Paddy, that's amazing. What are you talking about? It wouldn't matter to me.
But on that note, let me read, and this might make you cringe and want to run into the other room, but this is what George R. R. Martin said, and I just want to say it for the record. The character he created for the show is so much more powerful and tragic and fully fleshed than my own version in Fire and Blood that I'm half tempted to go back and rip up those chapters and rewrite the whole history of his reign. Paddy deserves an Emmy for this episode alone. If he doesn't get one, hey, there's no justice. So that's the guy.
Well,
that's the man.
There are far greater injustices in the world, but for George to say that, it's really humbling, and I can't, you know, I think that's an amazing thing to do, to have the author and creator of that world say those things that you've made a character greater than they, you know. The thing is that, you know, Viserys was on the script. You know, when I talk of improvisation, I don't mean we went in and it was like Goodfellas. You know, it wasn't. It's just the odd flourish. It's the thing you felt. And I always had this thing of when I die, I know what I see and I know what I want to see. And I kept that a secret. And I don't know if I even spoke to Geeter about it. I can't remember. But to have it was always there. But what happened early on was we did a dreadful read through. It was COVID. We were all 20 meters apart from each other. Right. It felt like we were doing it on megaphones. It was like in a spaceship. It was odd. It was weird. Everybody was projecting, you know, and all this shit. And it was horrible. And afterwards, Miguel looked worried. And I thought, oh, here's the part where they know they've fucked up and they've hired the wrong person. And he went, we need to put more Paddy in it. And I went, okay. And he went, it's missing Paddy. And I just went, bang, you fucking got it then. If you want Paddy, let's do it. And it just gave me the confidence and the license to go, right, I'm bringing everything to him. And that's what I did. And just from that moment on, when you know you're allowed the freedom of a character and you're not there battling over the minutiae and nonsense that can happen sometimes, I think after so many months in, it was like, just trust the guy. He is Viserys. He knows this guy. And you have to do that as a writer sometimes. You just got to hand this over to somebody and go, listen, I'm here to guide you, but this is your journey now.
Right.
But for George to say that is the greatest compliment. It's amazing, really.
is, you know, we've been talking about the kind of that, you know, self-doubt, that imposter syndrome thing. And you look, you had, you know, early success once you kind of committed to acting. I mean, I would say, did you like, was there a job that scarred you or something? Like, were you fired from an early job? Like, what happened?
I never got fired from anything. It wasn't that. I was a very lucky kid in that I got out of the blocks with a decent body of work. You know, yeah. I mean, Ken Meadows got the, you know, he's the guy that got me back into wanting to act again. So there was Romeo Brass with him. I worked with Pavel Pavlikovsky on a couple of his early films, you know. I worked with Jim Sheridan. I worked with Michael Winterbottom, you know.
Absolutely,
It was amazing. But I feel that something got stuck at some point, and it was probably around the time of Dead Man's Shoes,
right,
that something got stuck, and something in me was going like, something's not working here for me. I feel like I have all this potential, but I don't really know what to do with it. And, you know, I got offered, I'd had a role in The Bourne Ultimatum, which was a really big film, but it was a big film. It didn't need me in it at all, you know, and that's not self-deprecating. It's a fact. I loved working with Paul Greengrass. I was a great, great filmmaker, and I was working with Matt every day. You know, but I was playing this journalist who's sitting there watching Mac do kung fu and that. I'm going, well, I can do that. I'll help you one. I can fucking right. And you're sort of sitting there going, what am I doing here? You know, like, there wasn't a big film, but I knew that it wasn't a moment for me in a career sense or even an acting sense that people would go, oh, God, you were great as that Guardian journalist in The Bourne Ultimatum.
People rarely say the eighth lead in the action movie. They're not going to say this is the one. This is it. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I get it.
But it's a great film. It's a great film.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely grateful for the chance. But there was a couple of moments on that even when I thought, you know, I'm not sure about this anymore. I don't know what's going on. And I started to feel that early. And then, you know, Dead Man's Shoes was something. I did the Red Riding trilogy, which was a great show that we did in England. You look at it now, I mean, it's smashed. You know, you put that out on Netflix or brought it out as a new drama, it's
Andrew Garfield, an amazing cast. Yeah.
Yeah, we had an incredible cast. Everybody was in it. Yeah. We all got paid nothing.
Of course.
I remember being on the set of that. I stood with Peter Morland and there's Dave Morrissey and, you know, there's Sean Bean and, like you say, there's Andrew Garfield and everybody's doing their thing, you know. We're all crossing over because we're shooting these different years. And I remember having a conversation with Peter Mullen about the fact that we were getting paid nothing. And I said, well, why did you do it then? You know, and he said, well, I do it because they said you would. I did it because they said you were doing it. And I went, well, I only did it because they said you were doing it. And everyone was turning around and went, well, I only did it because you did it. And everyone, you know, this isn't showing everybody, but the vibe on the set was, oh, I did it because they said you did. And I went, they got us all to do it on the back of each other.
We're all idiots.
You know, that's how they capital and got us on it. But it was a really great piece of work. James Marsh directed one that I did. You know, gone on to do some great documentaries and film work. So, you know, I think Dead Man's Shoes is probably the thing that just became a bit of a weight, not in terms of the film. It's an incredible film. And I think it's a powerful performance, but it became a weight around my neck for a long time. And I couldn't break it. And didn't matter what I did, it said, oh, you'll never beat Dead Man's Shoes. And I'm going, I'm not here to beat anything. And then Dead Man's Shoes is further and further in the distance. And I'm going, is anything going to come?
Yeah.
To change the consciousness just a little bit, because, you know, I could say, oh, the firm and Gary Oldman, oh, you know, Made in Britain and Tim Roth, I could pick out those guys, but they kind of did work that, you know, sort of pushed them further on down the line. And I'm still sitting here going, what's going on? I'm still the guy in the green coat. And I think sometimes it builds up it built up a kind of resentment. And it was only because I'm going, I'm capable of more. That's great. And I can do that. But in some ways, playing that character wasn't a challenge to me. Playing Viserys was a challenge, but playing that character wasn't a challenge. And, you know, just having that sense that you've got so much more to give and that you want to learn about this thing that you're now suddenly doing and you're making a living from, but you're feeling so, you know, terribly insecure about. I'd been offered a script years ago, and it was to play this leading role, and it was so one-dimensional. And I said, I can't do this. I said, I can't do it. It's all about running and jumping over shit. And I said, I'm like, there's nothing there. And then there was another role in it of King Charles the First, and I went, I'll play the king.
Yeah.
And I looked at it and I went, I could do some of that. I could turn that into a Phil Hoffman type, like he was even in A Long Came Polly, you know, he flounces on the stage on that wonderful moment. And I'm like, I can do something like that with this. And I said, I'll do the king. Oh, no, no. No, we don't really see you as a king, you know? So you'd have to deal with that.
Well, that's the thing. He's got his Funko King. Who's the king now?
Who's the king now? Mother liquor.
I also have to say, I mean, like, I took the opportunity when I knew I was going to talk to you just to dive down the Hot Fuzz YouTube rabbit hole to watch some of your scenes.
Oh, God.
You and Rafe. Oh, my God. It's just, it makes me laugh so much. Did it feel, I mean, were you, I mean, I know I've talked to Edgar a lot about that film and obviously the Michael Bay influence. Did you go back to Michael Bay? Did you look at like any specific character tropes to, no, it was just all instinct. What was it?
Sometimes, you know, this is the funny thing with characters and research. Sometimes research is really, really helpful.
Sure.
But I know those guys are very much go to certain movies and look at certain movies. The only thing in it was like Point Break was the first film that me and my wife went to see together.
Oh.
We've been together 31 years this year or something. We've been married for 20 years, and that was the first film that we went to see at the cinema together.
I love
but,
it. Yeah.
Hot Fuzz to me wasn't like that. I mean, we did, myself and Rafe did go out to Wells, or we went somewhere near Bristol and we met a couple of detectives as part of our research, you know, and Edgar sent us on a research trip. And the first time I met Rafe actually was, you know, was waiting in this sort of hotel bar thing when I got off the train, and then we got picked up and went to meet these detectives. And they were kind of like the Andes. They weren't comical, but they were like the Andes. And you know, they were telling us about all the various murders and the cases in the area. And they couldn't wait to show us the pictures of dead bodies. You know, they had this thing of like, you know, well, this happened to such and such. We walked in the room and this body, it was like something from Indiana Jones. We'll show you in a minute, you know. They couldn't wait to get the grotesque. And then at one point, one of them says, I'm going up the road to the bakery. Does anyone want a flapjack? Like, and in the thing, you know, everyone's buying cakes and that in Hot Fuzz. And I always felt like, is that cassette this up or something? But these guys had so many similarities to the Andes that they were off to buy cakes and flapjacks and things like that. But that was the extent of the research. Me and Rafe just...
I mean...
We were like naughty kids at school. That's the only way to describe it. We became our own little thing. You know, and we became the Andes, and we had a good laugh, and it was, well, man, that film was like going to school. It was like, well, being at school.
Yeah, you can imagine, like, that's the beauty of a film like that, that is so rich in every smaller character, is like you could watch the movie about those characters. You imagine the broader life of those characters. Yeah. That's what's on screen.
Yeah. But I've got to say, that's Edgar's writing, and that's Edgar. And sometimes, I won't say give you a line read, but it sometimes it reminded me of Bruce Robinson, you know, when you see documentaries talking about Neil by mouth, get in the back of the van and all that, you know.
Right.
Edgar would sometimes be riffing with you and he'd say a line and you'd go, oh, okay, is that how you want me to say it?
Because he's made the movies in his head already. He's got it there already.
Yeah, he makes movies in his head. And it wasn't every time, it wasn't for every line, but you went, oh, okay. And actually, it did inform you of where you could go with the character, and then you could really go to town with all them one liners, like, you know, you've got a mustache and all that. But what Edgar does allow for is for those moments, like, I had to laugh because in this Empire magazine poll of the best shots in Edgar Wright film, the shot from Hot Fuzz was number one, and it was like the shot where, you know, Simon and Nick are in the frame and there's me and Rafe, and, you know, I lean out of frame and then come back in, and then
he comes back in. Yeah.
Hey, my God, you know, a centimeter less, an inch more, whatever. But it's perfect. It's just up to the gods how that happened. So we both come back into frame, you know, and that got voted the best shot. And I just laughed and I said to Edgar, I said, how ironic for all the whip pans of mad shit that you do for films, that a static shot wins the best.
Just two guys coming back. I see it on Twitter every day. It's fantastic. This might be the biggest this might be the biggest challenge for you, Patty. Rank the Rocky films for me. Give me I know you are an uber Rocky fan.
Yeah, I love Rocky.
Where do you stand? I mean,
Rocky changed my life. Rocky was the film that changed my life when I was a little kid. That was the film that I watched, and I watched that very young, and I went, that's it, I'm getting out of here, I'm doing something with my life. That was it. I wasn't
Was it the film or the narrative behind the film? Because you could apply it to both. Like, both things are inspiring. Stallone's story.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very much Rocky. I was like, no, you know, I want to, and that idea, you know, that I want to be somebody. That sort of on the water from, you know, as it origins in that, you know, I could have been a contender and all that stuff. Sure. You can see that in Rocky. And then, I just want to be somebody. And I think that's what I felt as a kid when I watched it. I used to walk around and roll my shoulders when I was walking on my own and, you know, do a bit of shadow boxing and things like that. I loved it. I think I rank the Rockies the best. The first one is the best. I think Rocky 2 is the second best. I think that's a fantastic film. So many great, great moments in it. I think Rocky 3 is third.
Wow. Okay. We're getting controversial now, I think. But continue. Okay.
There's no world in which Rocky Balboa is a heavyweight in that film, by the way. He looks like a lightning. Even so, in the commentary, they have to say, he looks like a middleweight. Someone likes going, just say that.
Because they're not going to buy it. We got to say, got to own up to it. Yeah.
A heavyweight. But it's a great story. And I think the great characters, great writing. Brilliant acting. And then I would go from three to Rocky Balboa.
That was a good one. Yeah.
And I think the worst is
it's got to be five, right? Yeah, five's the worst.
Yeah, and four. When I watch four these days, I tried to watch that extended cut of four with a few.
Yep.
And I was like, you know, because I loved it. When I watched it at the cinema, by the way, when I was in my teens, the place was... it was like being at a fight.
Oh yeah,
everybody went nuts. They were cheering. People were throwing coins at the screen when Ivan Drago came on, and you could see the screen go like ripple. I thought, wow, this is on. I've never been in a film like that before. But four to me, when I watched it last, it felt like a series of pop videos.
Oh, it is. I mean, there are montages in there that are, I mean, it is the distillation of the 1980s in a 90-minute movie. It's barely a movie, honestly, but it's, as you, I have fond remembrances of watching as a kid. It is what it is. And do you like the Creed movies? Were you out on Creed?
I didn't like them as much.
Really?
I didn't like them as much. No, I didn't. If I'm being honest, I don't like being really, you know, sour or anything like that, or critical of other work, but I love those Rocky films. They've got a massive Rocky cut. Actually, but it's boxed up at the minute. And I just feel that the heart of Rocky was all those wonderful characters, you know, of Mickey and Paulie and Adrian. Yeah. And that was the Rocky world to me. And when they died, I think Rocky died. And I never quite felt arrested by what's his name? His son in it, Apollo's son.
Yeah, Michael B. Jordan as Creed, yeah, yeah.
Apollo. Yeah, but it's not him as an actor, man. It's not.
No, I got you, I got you. Yeah. No, I mean, it's the character, as you said, we fell in love with,
Yeah, I never felt that same thing. And I hated Rocky V when all of a sudden he had nothing again. You know, he went, and that was a pretty shit film anyway, wasn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah, it didn't ring true. They kept going vacillating back and forth. His net worth would just go back and forth by such degrees every film. It was like, where are we at now?
That's what they became. But the first few, there was really, really great heart in them and fantastic sports on.
I'll let you go, man. I really appreciate the time. I mean, I could geek out with you.
Although
you
want to rank the Rambo film.
Rambo? Oh God, Rambo films? Those are few and far between, my friend. I don't know how you feel. First Blood. I have a soft spot for Rambo, the second one, because that's again a pure 80s movie. But the rest.
Do you know Rambo 3, when that came out, I got hold of a really terrible black and white pirate version of it on VHS. And I had a screening at my mate's house, and I charged mates a pound to watch it, to come didn't watch it. So I fleeced them all. I made about 5 or 6 quid out of it. And they sat there watching a black and white version of it. And the picture was jumping all over the place. And it was absolutely awful. But everybody sat through it, you know, pinned to it.
Hopefully it'll be better in black and white. Yeah. congratulations. What's that?
I said it's classic in black and white.
Everything becomes classic in black and white. Yeah, that's how you do it. That's why the only criticism of your show is like one of the episodes people are like, it's too dark. I can't see it. It's classier that way. Just make it darker. It's classy.
Just make it dark. They do make things too dark these days. It is true. And my wife even said that actually. She can't see anything. And I went,
Just lean in.
It's like when people come up to me and complain to me about the title music. Oh, you know, why haven't they got new title music? Right. Going, fucking no, mate. What do you want me to do about it? Hang on a minute. I'll just give them a ring and let's find out. Just don't. I don't know, mate.
Let's see the Funko doll one more time before we go.
This is a big moment. I got one of these. Look.
Congratulations. Can you see him? I definitely can. I would, if I were you, I would have a wall of those. That's amazing.
I hope they bring a variant out with his mask and things like that. And what else have I got? Oh, I've got my dragon. The only thing I was given this. I say I nicked it from the set. I did nick a couple of these and they asked for them back. And one of the props guys went, I'll lose my job. And I went, oh, bro, listen, man, listen, I'll get them back to you ASAP. I thought, oh, I won't miss them. And they count everything. So all I got here out of this set was this lovely dragon from my model of old Valyria. That's all I came away with.
No mask, no staff, no...
No mask, no, and I got a coin.
Okay. Okay.
You won't see what's on it. That's the dragon crest, and that's me when I'm young with no beard. And I haven't even got Targaryen long hair on it, so I don't know what that's all about. It's supposed to be me, but you don't look anything like me.
All right. That's the Black Man. Enjoy Halloween. And
thanks,
enjoy the fair.
Thanks for your time.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.